Erlem Sports.
Hello and welcome to the Verulam Sport Podcast. Every week, the team behind the award-winning Radio Verulam Sports Show will provide you with the most relevant news from the local and regional sporting scenes, whilst keeping you in the picture with national and international bulletins from the world of sport. There will be topical debates, regular interviews from local talent, and chats with those big-name guests that are a mainstay of Verulam Sport. As always, this is your show, every bit as much as it is ours. So, check out Verulam Sport across social media and get involved. For now, prepare yourself for this week's action-packed Verulam Sport Podcast. Hello and welcome again to Verulam Sport Sportcast on your Saturday evening, 6 through 7 o'clock, where each and every single week, the team behind the award-winning Verulam Sports debate, dissect and analyse a vital sporting topic. Ordinarily, it's of your choosing because always it's your show. It's your show every bit as much as it is ours. However, on occasion, we do like to kind of be a bit unilateral on our debating topics. And since over recent weeks, we've prized open Pandora's box and considered and alluded to reasons perhaps why England haven't won anything in football since 1966. For me, that's an abject joke, and we'll analyse that. We felt as though it was appropriate in international weekend with the away from the Premier League and the return of the international football scene for us to get to grips with this, to really get to the minutiae of why it is the case that England haven't won any major international footballing trophy since 1966. And that indeed is going to be the focus of tonight's topic of discussion. But I know you've got great opinions on this. Maybe it's the media, maybe it's the pressures of 66. Maybe we're just all expecting just too gosh darn much of our footballing stars. Love your views. Tweet us at Verulam Sport. Get involved. Remember, it's your show. Every single bit as much as it is ours. Really looking forward to getting into this because we've been talking about it on and off. Well, since we really got going on Verulam Sports, I think it really is one of those national debates and we like to get our teeth into it. And I'm delighted now to really begin unpacking this with the machine, Jason McKenna. Jason, good evening. How are you?
I'm good, Tony. Really excited for this discussion here because, that, as you said, we've teased it for a little while here. I think a lot of people have a lot of opinions, and on the social media, it's been lighting up with people's points of view as to why England have failed since 1966. So starting off with Susie, she said that the players are too much of prima donnas now, and back in the old days, they had pride to wear the shirt. Michael said the golden generation failure was down to managers being scared of the press, something that you've just talked about there, Tony. Richard says too many players care for club rather than country. Ian says the league is too physically demanding. Annie has said too many foreigners stifling the growth of young English players. Mark has said the quality between top teams have equaled out due to training and technology. Only one team can win, so England shouldn't be too disappointed. And John has messaged in, and I think this is referring to one reason why England have failed, but he said Glenn Hoddle destabilised the team with his very controversial book. But we're kind of looking at overarching themes there, and are there any there that you want to pick out from our amazing social media suggestions from our great, great listeners?
I love them all, but neither do I buy any of them. I just think, you know, if you look at other sports in that over 50 years time span, and again, we mustn't forget, this is really where I come from here, because football is the most popular sport by a country mile, not just in England, but of course the world as well. We must respect that. But if you look at the resources that England boast, it surpasses almost all of the world in terms of monetary income, number of players playing the game from a young level coming up. You know, just the whichever way you slice it, if you consider it almost metaphorically a game of cards, then England hold all the aces and yet have won precisely nothing since 66. Again, just to give it its sporting context,
England, of course, gloriously won the World Cup in 2003, the only Northern Hemisphere team to do that. They've also been in, I think, four other finals, obviously falling short. They've, of course, won the One Day International cricket. And I'm going to use that because we spoke brilliantly with Chris Wokes, ODI winner, World Cup winner on that. And we're going to refer to that in just a second. But, you know, an ODI victory in a world level in cricket. There's also been a T20 victory for England. You know, again, if you consider, I know it's not just England, but the whole of the island, Great Britain, in that time, England have become the only Olympic nation. So Great Britain, the only Olympic nation ever to improve on a medal of performance post hosting the event. So we eulogized about the wonderful 2012 Olympics. And actually, if you look at it, it's remarkable. They're the only Olympic nations to actually improve medal performance in five consecutive Olympic Games. So just trending upwards. And I understand lottery funding has kind of amplified that. But again, my point is, compare all those sports to football, and in terms of infrastructure, fan base, finances, which way you like to slice it, football has the ascendancy. And in context, my point really overarching is that it's an abject failure. And there must be something culturally wrong for us to have not got any trophies at all. And again, if we're going to put it in its footballing context only, I totally get the beautiful game and the mega qualities of all the world players. I totally get that, right? But even in a European context, where in the last, you know, let's call it again, that's 66 period and onwards, Denmark have got a European trophy. Greece have got a European trophy. You know, I mean, if you look again in terms of player resource, finances, they would look at England with absolute envy. But we look at them with envy in terms of what they've actually won. So for me, this is precisely why we're having this conversation. I'm framing it firmly in its cultural context here. It is, I can't think of any other word, an absolute joke. I would actually use the word borderline offensive to me that given all the resources, et cetera, we have got nothing in our England footballing trophy cabinet since that glorious year in July 1966. But we're going to spend the next bit of time debating and dissecting that. Maybe I'm a bit harsh. I'd love your views on it. Maybe that might I have hyperinflated expectations. Get involved. It's your show. Tweet us at Verulam Sport. Would dearly love to hear from you. Anyway, it's appropriate, as I say, that we're having this conversation now because it is International Weekend. That means no Premier League action. But a reminder also that when the Premier League returns, so will our Premier League Predictions League. And we know you at home are a punditry guru. You get all the goals and the games right, and you get all the right results. I know you do. I can see your smug face, and you're welcome to it. But get involved with us every week throughout the Premier League season. Tweet your predictions and see if you can match and indeed better us here on the Verulam Sports team. Very simple rules. If you get, and I know you will, the correct scoreline in any game, score yourself 3 points. It's 1 point if you get the correct result, but you might be out by a goal or two here or there. No shame in that. But there's nil point, nothing in our game for getting the wrong result entirely. With all that being said, 4 weeks into the Premier League action, and we're getting International Weekend this very weekend round. The scores on the Verulam Sports team's prediction doors read like this. New recruit Neil Stock is still bringing up the rear, but he had a good week last week, moves up to 20 points. The voice of the Saints, Graham Griffin, check him out, providing live commentary all season long from Clarence Park on the red button on the award-winning Radio Verulam Sports. Voice of the Saints, GG, had a stumbling week last week by his great standards, has 21 points. The Machine, Jason McKenna, a little bit ahead of GG, has 24 points. Previous pace setter, the always legendary ace man, Matthew Turvey, has 30 points. And whilst I generally consider myself to be quite poor in the prediction sphere, I am defending champion and I've nudged ahead. Currently, after four rounds, I have 31 points. But I just know. You're better than us. You get them right all the time. Tweet us at Verulam Sport. Get involved. So that's the Verulam Sports prediction Premier League. But of course, Jason, no Premier League action this week, and it is international time, and it's time now for us to consider why England haven't won anything whatsoever since 66. I mentioned Chris Wokes. I'm going to introduce that in a moment, but before then, quickly, Jason, am I being a little harsh? Am I being a little heavy-handed? Are my expectations too inflated? And, you know, is it just one of those things that England haven't won anything post-66? Your thoughts, quickly.
I'm quite critical myself, and we'll also get into it, but I do also have to put the other point that only one team can win a tournament, and obviously there's been ample opportunity between then, but you do have to consider the likes of France, Germany, Holland, but even Holland haven't lifted a major tournament. There's been plenty of teams that have kind of contested and been world-class or had a world-class generation in between 66 and now. But to you know, back up your point there, Tony, I'm also in total agreement that it's been a shambles in the way that England have organised it. And I wonder if we'll have converging reasons why, because I've got some pretty kind of fleshed out ideas why England have failed, and hopefully if the England hierarchy are listening, maybe it will help prevent it in the future.
Absolutely. Now, again, before we really get down into the minutiae and hear those fleshed out thoughts, whilst we're award-winning, Jason McConnell, no boast there, it's an absolute fact. It's also fair to say that like most of the world, we are just excited fans hoping for the best, and we have the privilege to put our two pennies out there via the power of podcasting and, of course, on 92.6 FM Radio Verulam. Point is, though, we're many, many things on planet Earth, you and I, Mr. McKenna, but we are not World Cup winners. We have had the luxury, though, as I've referenced, of speaking with many World Cup winners. One of those, Chris Wokes, an instrumental part in the tremendous ODI, One Day International World Cup victory for England in home turf just last year. Now, I actually asked him at the end of this question, this very topic, this very focus that we're talking about tonight, as a World Cup winner, why haven't England won any more in football? As his perspective, of course, is steered from that World Cup winning stance. I know now we've got that clip, and I think it will give a good framework and context before we really do flesh things out still further. So, yeah, it'd be good if we could now hear those thoughts from an earlier chat with Chris Wokes.
Yeah, it's, obviously, I wish I had the answer. I wish I had the exact answer. We could all lift a World Cup. It would be amazing for the nation. And obviously, not that long ago, we got close, but not quite close enough. And I think that's been our best, one opportunity, but also two, our best performance for a long time. I look at the team now and I feel like the system is working. We've got a great team. You can clearly see us playing in a different manner to England teams have done in the past. But to answer the question bluntly, I suppose, is you look at, some of the teams we've had over the years, the Beckhams, the Nevilles, the Gerrards, the Lampards, some great players and some great teams, and unfortunately just haven't been able to do it. I haven't got the sole reason why that is, but I think if you look across the board, a lot of pressure is put on our footballers, isn't it? We certainly build them up to make sure we bring them right down to the bottom as well. Mm-hmm. So, as a professional cricketer and who's certainly been put under pressure at certain times during my career, it does have an effect. There's no doubt about that. They're human beings. They're out there playing football, and of course they play the hell of paying that have a lot of money. But still, sometimes pressure does take its toll. But I also believe a big problem in professional football is that the clubs rule the roost.
Yeah.
And playing for England a lot of the time comes second, which, well, basically in any other sport, that's not the case. Mm-hmm. Playing for your country is the number one. And just unfortunately, that's probably not the case in football. Well, not for every player anyway. Don't get me wrong. I know some players are extremely passionate and want to play for the country and, certainly want to do the best for England. But I just think that clubs do rule the roost, and sometimes players are kind of loyal to their clubs a lot of the time, which is, everyone's got to earn a living regardless of how much money you earn. I think that does play a huge part in how England play their football and how it has done in the past. Anyway, I think we're moving in the right direction. There's some really exciting players. Playing for England obviously does mean a lot to a lot of players.
So, yeah, Jason, great to hear there from Chris. Again, the World Cup winner as he is. And the key thing there for me that's emerged from that, again, he says himself that he doesn't have all the answers, and why would he? But he makes a clear distinction, doesn't he, between the culture of cricket and football, where, again, cricket, the goal of any youngster is to play for England. It's the zenith of the game. And accordingly, they are essentially contracted, which basically means that their money comes from representing the country. Whereas, of course, in football, I know there's appearance fees, but they're very kind of almost incidental compared to the salary masters, which are the clubs. I can't ever envisage that culture pivoting, but I do wonder perhaps if that might be a massive impact, and that ultimately people's main drive in football is to be a star for a club and make a name, maybe even more so these days, and become a brand into and of itself. Whereas in cricket, it remains the case. The goal, the driver, the focus is to get to that international arena. What's your take on that? I know it was came up in our social media engagements.
For me, it's not an argument that I actually buy, because at the end of the day, I look at other countries around the globe and they don't have the same problem. You know, you look at the recent World Cup winners, France, and a lot of their squad actually do play in England. They play around Europe. They don't play in France, but they still have a pride to actually play for their country. But for me, it seems like an old footballing cliche to need to want to win. Mm-hmm. And also that this kind of psychological element of focus is lost because of earning money at a young age. I think it's a narrative overplayed. For me, that doesn't have much to do with it, because otherwise the nations around the world would possibly just the most restrictive abilities. You know, maybe Italy would be winning all the time because they have very strict rules on who and who cannot play in their league. So, yeah, I get where Chris is coming from, and that point of view, again, from the wonderful listeners of Verulam Sport. But for me, it's a deeper problem due to systems and maybe management, not even of the team itself, but the management of the managers of the team.
Yeah, do you know what? I think that's a really valid point. And we've spoken about systems, haven't we? And if we want to just briefly, I mean, there's been so many generations since that 66 moment. But there was that golden generation. It springs instantaneously to sort of our generation's mind, I suppose. And there was the debate, wasn't there? You know, how on earth can we get Gerrard and Lampard playing together? You know, Scholes for me has been recognized by Zidane, maybe one of the greatest players all time, as the most skillful player that he played against in his era. Really decided early to hang up his international boots because he was a bit of an international bit part player in context. So I just wonder, has there just been almost a challenge, not necessarily of system per se, but of managing egos and kind of finding the best balance during this quote unquote golden generation? Your thoughts on that from, I guess, a tactical and a management perspective?
I mean, I've got very fleshed out ideas here, and I think actually the tactical argument for it stems back many, many years, and it actually goes back to one man, Charles Reap. Now, for those of you not au fait with the story of him, you can see it all across the country, even now, the infatuation with the long ball. You can kind of hear at local levels, at grassroots, play it up to the big man when getting tough in fixtures, hoof it up there. And it's also why people said Pep would never do well in the English game. So, you know, I think it goes back to that ideology that Charles Reap actually brought into football in the early 70s and 80s. So, again, as I said here, the story of Charles Reap is he was the first data analyst in football, and I should like him a little bit more, but he was a person who kind of showed what goes wrong when you read data incorrectly. So he analysed the matches of his local team, Swindon Town, and he came to a realisation that most goals in football come off of plays that were preceded by three passes or fewer. Mm-hmm. So in Reap's mind, the basic truth of the game was that the key to winning matches was to be as simple as possible, cut out passing and possession, and get the ball downfield as possible. And we know it now, basically, as 4-4-2 long ball English football. And I would ask any kind of football fan to describe England post 1966, even pre 1966, and this style of football dominated the football that was in the British Isles. And you know, even to this, to the bitter end, in 1993. Reap explained that if a team tries to play football and keeps it down to more than three passes, there's a much higher chance of winning. And part of the problem was that Reap recommended this, and there was a couple of teams. One of our local teams, Watford, implemented it to much success, and also Wimbledon FC in the 1980s. And this coincided with the two clubs actually having a real patch of success. And this filtered through to the English hierarchy. And again, this is why I'm saying that this is all tactical, because the reason that England played that style so much is they thought that that was the best way statistically as well. Mm-hmm. And England's footballing policy from 66 then was totally dominated by this infatuation with the long ball. And Neil Payne, a data analyst of football, actually explains the contrary is true with football, that maintaining possession in football is better. You can create high and high quality chances. But there was also another coincidence in football that really damaged and cemented the 4-4-2 long ball system. And this was because in the 80s, England got banned from European football.
Yeah.
And this time away from Europe actually meant that the English teams weren't exposed to continental styles, and it really solidified that there was only one style to play, because every team that was winning the league in England was doing it. So what we kind of see is the European teams were experimenting with 4-4-3, 4-3-3 total football. Argentina, you know, Germany with their defensive football, Sacchi with his football, offside, compact lines, pressing football were all experimented with on the continent, whereas Britain was kind of left alone. And the Premier League came about. In many ways, it was a saving grace for England and the English team to an extent. But as the domestic league adapted, we had new methodologies, the likes of Wenger, Mourinho, shape-shifting Ferguson as well. You know, many people were worried that he, as a person from the 80s, would be stuck in his ways. But actually, he embraced new ideologies, whereas the England FA were kind of stuck listening to Stock, Aitken and Waterman. You know, they were so 80s old school.
But Jason, I get that. And I think you made some really fascinating and important points here. Because again, it comes down to cultural and, I guess, philosophical aspects. But again, you know, so much time has since elapsed, and still nothing in the trophy bank for England. As you know, again, you mentioned England, you know, sort of the FA wise stuck listening to, you know, Stock, Aitken and Waterman. But again, you know, then there was the Crozier era, which coincided with the brand Golden Generation in the very midst of kind of Rule Britannia, New Labour kind of zeitgeist. And yeah, there was that football coming home moment where we all believed it, won that home tournament in Euro 96. Again, a great squad assembled there, by the way. But still nothing to show. And I don't quite know. I believe there are many, many factors in this. But I just cannot move away from the fact that Denmark win the 92 Euros and they didn't even qualify. They just came in. Again, a political factor. Israel couldn't feature any further. So they step in. Granted, they had some great players, the great Dane, Peter Schmeichel, the Laudrup twins, a whole heap of others, many of whom, of course, plying their trade right around the world. Schmeichel, of course, England and Man United legend. You know, Greece win their home Euros, and England have nothing. There's been gallant efforts and there's been hope and optimism for many, many a time. But goodness gracious me, 1966 is pushing 60 years away. And we talk generations, that's almost five generations. And still, for some reason, we haven't yet found a way to conquer a global footballing tournament. And yeah, I get the aspects there of being missing that European exchange of philosophy and ideas. And I totally agree that for all too very long, we have been obsessed with what you may as well call direct football. But, you know, I just think that there are other factors. There must be why we haven't claimed a title in that time span, given so many other smaller nations can claim to be a champion. And you know, I just love your thoughts again as to other fascinating factors playing in here.
Well, I do want to actually challenge a little bit what you're saying there, because obviously the Premier League came about, but what my point is that the 1960s, 80s, whatever you want to put the era in, of the 4-4-2 long ball continued well after the advent of the Premier League. And the problem is that the FA has been stuck in that. And Michael Cox, really good football analyst, attested that as well, that at an international level, dealing with managers, the FA were behind the times and resistant to change and innovative ideas. All the managers that they brought in were either English or the most English foreigners that you could find. So I think this is where the problem is, Tony, that this ideology actually filtered down. And again, this is why England hasn't done as well as countries like Holland, because then England started choosing the wrong type of players. Mm-hmm. They started bringing through at the youth level, at grassroots level, and teaching the coaches as well to only look for quick, strong players. You know, they had to be tall as well. And imagine if Messi had been brought up in England, he would not have made it into the England side, and he probably would not have a look in at the moment. He probably would have either had to have gone to Europe, similarly to the likes of Jadon Sancho, or he would have just ended up working as a plumber or something, because they just wouldn't have given him the time of day. And I think this is the two-pronged argument that I have, is that the infatuation and obsession with long ball football meant that a generation, or even, let's say, five generations of footballers missed out because they weren't big, strong, tall. The slight players, the Iniestas of this world, would not have made it through. And only recently have we seen really good creative players. But even then, England just, there's something wrong. You know, the archetypal English player is still a big, strong, quick player. We don't seem to embrace a passing, beautiful style. So that's where I think this tactical problem from Charles Reap has filtered down at all levels. And I think it's going to take a long while, Tony, to change the grassroots football as well, the type of player coming through.
Do you know what, as well? I think I hear where you're coming from there, and I'm inclined to agree. We're going back a few years now, because, you know, I know the DNA program has been looking to kind of maybe readdress this and take on some lessons, perhaps from the likes of the culture at Barcelona, et cetera, et cetera. So I'm sure much has changed. We're going back a few years. But my young brother, he was a really rather good sportsman. He was actually on Leicester Tigers books in his youth, et cetera, et cetera. But he was always kind of had his head turned by football for a season. He kind of played football as opposed to rugby for a little while. So going back, going back a generation, so to speak, and I rather hope things have improved. But one thing that always struck me when every now and again I go to watch him was that these young kids, and they were kids, we're talking 9, 10, maybe 11 years of age, and they're playing on borderline full-size pitches. So they're taking corners, they can barely kick it across there. You know, whoever was able to, you know, have a powerful boot at that time, you know, there's always those kids that developed slightly earlier, whatever. You know, they could almost score from halfway because the goalkeeper was, you know, in such a dwarfed by the goals. And I know we're trying to improve, but these things do take time. I just find that I always was struck by how wrong that was. And I know in the culture of Dutch football, which you're so learned in, they much more about kind of ball control and kind of playing on smaller size pitches, getting technique mastered before then you progress up to a bigger level. I'm sure now England have taken on those lessons, but I guess we were always playing catch up because, like I say, just going back a mere generation, it was always just peculiar to me watching on the sidelines, you know, often in, let's just call it English weather conditions. With these kids, you know, some of them knee-high to a grasshopper, running around on a borderline full-size pitch. And it's not conducive to mastering the kind of techniques that you will need to demonstrate as you progress up to the highest level. And, of course, internationally, it's where the elite lives and breathes. So, yeah, I guess I'm hoping things have improved, Jason, but just your thoughts on this kind of grassroots issue that was certainly manifest, let's call it 15, 20 years ago.
Yeah, I think it's been a little bit longer than that. And if anything, kind of bringing in the discussion about what one of the brilliant listeners has actually said about too many foreigners in the Premier League. But I would argue that the reverse has actually been the impact of it. The reverse of bringing foreigners in has meant that at a grassroots level, they've actually had to kind of reconsider things. You know, I'm sure Jimmy Floyd Hasselbank, who's, you know, gone down a few divisions there, but he is a Dutch manager. He probably has gone into his club and gone, oh, you're training your players like this. This isn't what we do in Holland. And Holland, in a slightly measurable way, have been more successful in England. I mean, they've got to a World Cup final more recently than England. They probably turned out more talent. So, yeah, I totally agree with you. And I really like the story, actually, that you gave. I can't remember which one of our podcasts it was, but it was the story about in New Zealand, how they train the young rugby players. And instead of doing it in age groups, they do it in size groups. Yep. And again, that could be something. Obviously, it's a different sport, but the size thing, once again, could be factored in here. You could have the smaller, more tactical players play with each other, the bigger ones, and then maybe make them play against each other every so often, but hone those skills because you can't have every player playing in the same style. Otherwise, it just won't work. And I think you've hit the nail on the head there that it's a training style that everybody has to be at the same level. But in New Zealand, they realise that players, people have different capabilities and that needs to be welcomed.
Jason, great points. And that's a great culture in New Zealand's rugby team where rugby is God. And maybe the same way that football is God here is kind of showing them to, despite, again, all that pressure, we'll talk pressure in the England's footballing context, has seen them become multiple World Cup winners, as you broke down. Literally, I think they start off kind of on an age kind of bracket. But then, you know, I played rugby to a reasonably high level up until about 15, 16. And it does get to that point where, you know, again, you get those kids that develop earlier and they're just so much physically more dominant. And then it just ceases to become rugby because you just pass the ball to that guy and he just walks his way through Allah doing his best Jonah Lomu impression and kind of getting tries. Again, it's not conducive to long-term productivity. And again, I think New Zealand have got that really, really strong. Now, we've addressed there the different kind of attitudes and cultural approaches to training that other sports can adopt. I wonder, Jason, it's quite a big question, this one. Is there maybe one of the causes for this paucity in success at the international football level? Is there maybe a sense, I know Southgate's begun to explore other avenues, but the football almost is a little bit insular here. Whereas, for instance, in a rugby union context, I know Clive Woodward, who, let's not forget, when he took over the reins, 97, as the head coach of England, didn't even so much as have an office. But he was, again, a little bit mad scientist-esque in his experimentation. But that experimentation proved worthwhile in the sense that it yielded, just 6 years later, World Cup triumph. Remains England's only World Cup, but also the Northern Hemisphere's only World Cup victory to date in rugby. Now, Clive was very assiduous and very diligent and very proactive in exploring lots of different sports. He went out to the States, took in some American football. He studied actually football and football methodologies because, again, they were light years ahead in terms of professionalism at that point. But he was willing and open to embracing all different types of methodologies and in the sense that rugby needed to play catch up, and they caught up in a 6 year span. I just wonder if one of the causes for the football internationally not having any successes post 66, is it the case that there is a sense that we are England, we are football, this is our place, and, you know, almost a divine right, a sense of privilege for success, and not maybe having that openness to explore and take good things from other sporting cultures. Your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I totally agree with you, actually, in terms of maybe there's a divine right in British football. In terms of comparing to other sports, I don't know the ins and outs of how England function in maybe looking into this, but, you know, you can always learn from other people, other sports, even as rugby is a different way of playing with a ball to the foot, but also with your hands. But in terms of it, I think what you're kind of hinting at a little bit there as well, and something that England actually did embrace and had huge benefits at this last World Cup, was previously there was a lack of embracing marginal gains in terms of set pieces. And this goes into the mind frame of a lot of elite clubs. It's a big, big problem in the Premier League. But I think, you know, elite clubs, even around the world at international level, they just don't work on set pieces because they think, well, we're really good passers of the ball, or we're really good shooters. We don't need to worry about that. That's what minnows do. And in terms of it, you see teams like Burnley in terms of Premier League and then like Iceland in terms of international league. These are teams that worked on the fact that, you know what, we're not very good at a lot of things, but what we can be good at is set pieces where we control the ball and the situation totally. And we saw that actually Gareth Southgate brought that in. He worked on two of the biggest bogeys in terms of English football. And this is kind of giving me a little bit of hope, maybe positivity, that England may be able to break these down. But it was set pieces. And then I'm going to say the P word in terms of England, penalties. He actually worked on penalties. My goodness, after, is it four major World Cup outages at penalties, somebody thought, you know what, England aren't very good at penalties. The Germans are. Why is that? They brought in psychologists, they brought in data people, and they actually worked on it. So this divine right of, oh, well, you know, if it'll go to penalties, the lads have got a great line-hearted spirit, they'll chuck it in. Well, no, that's not good enough. You need to work on these things. So again, Tony, I think you've actually pointed out a really poignant problem that England have had, is that they've gone into tournaments quite often. You know, 1966, they'd obviously won it. 1970 onward, they were always harking back to, well, England have won it. They've won it recently. Then in the 80s, Liverpool were a dominant side, so they assumed that they would do well. The 90s, football's coming home, but they still didn't work on it. And I think from the 2000s, maybe because of actually accepting that there is a problem inherently within England, they've gone, right, we're going to try something different. And I think that really happened after the absolute embarrassment of the 2014 World Cup going out to Costa Rica. So I think hopefully there's a spirit of change, but I think you're right there, Tony. There's a lot still to learn.
Very, very well put. Now, when you were having that conversation there and making some great points, Jason, The thing that struck me, though, was when you talk incremental gain, inches adding up, again, it comes back down to the building a culture. The man who maybe wrote the book on that, and I know he's maybe latterly some things have kind of muddied his waters, but I'm talking about Sir David Brailsford, who, again, we're talking culture. Cycling, Tour de France in this country, at Olympics, was, you know, it was very much third, fourth, fifth tier kind of sporting aspect in terms of its connectivity to the British sporting psyche, just generally speaking. And Brailsford came in and he forced in by a culture, by inch, by committing to perfection, but understanding that is a livid process. A culture that has seen England, you know, become so instrumental with cycling, both at the Olympic level and, of course, in many recent years, successes at the Tour de France. As I say, I'm just bubbling that because I'm aware there are subsequent slightly muddied waters. But the point, the reason that I brought that up is, number one, the incremental gains aspect, which is critical. But number two, that was done with a sport which was, I wouldn't say alien to the British sporting psyche, but my goodness me, if you compare it to football, which this is my major point, is our national game. The love, the passion, the resources that we have for football is astonishing, it's staggering. And as I say, to achieve those goals over time and prove that in a cycling context, almost from ground zero, Clive Woodward, again, if you think about it, England rugby professional in rugby union only began 95. Clive Woodward began 97, 2003 Rugby World Cup winners. So things can happen. Momentum is a wonderful thing. It can happen quickly. But this is the question that we're analysing, Jason. And again, I'd love your kind of insights here. Why is it that in a sporting culture so well embedded, so well established, has it taken us this long, 50 plus years, nearly 60 years, for us to kind of wake up to the need to seek these incremental gains? Why have we been so stuck in our ways? Love your thoughts on that.
Well, I think it's the fact that you've explained is because it is 50 years, it is a sport, and it's really hard to break a psyche, you know, an embedded system. Building a culture, as you said there, is much easier in an infantile sport because basically you can do whatever you want and there's not going to be many eyes upon you. But because football is the national game, generally experiments aren't allowed. And that's why, you know, following Terry Venables, El Tel, he was probably the most progressive experimental manager, you know, with his Christmas tree formation. At least he tried something different. And then you went back to Sven Hoddle. You had Roy Hodgson, who, you know, I don't want to disrespect them, but they're basically the run of the crop, the traditional manager. So I think that was part of the problem. Coupled with that was the fact that we did have a golden generation. So the FA were thinking, God, right, we have to do what we've done before and it will work this time. We can't try anything different because then we'll be criticised by the public. And I think that actually, again, pointing to the 2018 Russia World Cup, because, you know, we did have Harry Kane, Sterling was quite good, but really there was no other world-class players. It wasn't a golden generation. I think the FA kind of worked on this DNA project, but also thought, well, we're not likely to win this tournament. Let Gareth Southgate actually try something different. And I think because there wasn't a lot of expectation, because there was no build-up, it actually paid off because they were allowed to do something different. And what I would also add, Tony, in terms of the building the culture thing, I think the teams you mentioned earlier, you know, the likes of Denmark and Greece, they were lucky in the sense that they had one tournament which was fantastic, but they played to the style that suited the players. And with the other teams that dominate football for years and years, the Spains, but also at a club level, the Barcelonas, they had a philosophy. So there's two ways that you can either go with football management. You either go with what fits the players at the time, pragmatic, probably the Mourinho approach, or you go the philosophy approach and develop something. And I think this is kind of linked to it, building a culture. England hasn't focused on building a culture of either philosophy or pragmatism. And I think if players don't have something to believe in, if they don't bring in somebody who either speaks to them and says, look, we're going to play to your strengths or we're going to build something, then what do they really have to aspire to? You know, obviously you'd say they want to win, but if they can't believe that this person's got the answers and they're just doing the same old, why would they believe that something different is going to happen if they're being told the same thing? So I think that linked to the building culture thing, England didn't decide whether they were going to play to how the players should play or how the philosophy of the team should be for years to come. You know, there should be an England style like there is with a Spain style, a Dutch style, a Brazilian style.
Yep, absolutely. And again, when you think back to 1966 and all that, they were the wingless wonders. And, you know, Alf Ramsey essentially kind of broke all football rationale at that time, which was all about kind of getting to the byline, whipping it into a big fellow to nod it home. And, you know, he said, well, we've got no wingers, but we're just going to play the best players we've got. World Cup winner. Thank you very much indeed. A couple of things, so many fascinating points you've raised there. And I know you listening have got loads of fascinating points. Come on. Why haven't England won the World Cup? You've got the answers. If you were managing England, I know you would. We'd be three-time World Cup champions and, you know, sweeping all before us. Get involved. Help us out. Tweet at Verulam Sports. Jason, a couple of things there. Firstly, I like the positivity in the sense that it sounds to me that you do have faith in Southgate. And I like the DNA programme. I think they've really committed to this. And we've seen that bear fruits at under 17 level, under 19 level, under 21 level too. So again, the underlay, the cultural developments seem to me like they are well placed. And I like that. I'm still questioning South Park, goodness me, because I would like to say this, coming back to that no pressure World Cup, as you've framed it really well. They still actually, I think, either lost or drew more matches than they actually won. It was a bit of a freakish tournament. Also, and I've said this on several other podcasts, again, sometimes you make your own luck by seizing the day, a la the Denmark team, who, again, let's not forget it, they didn't even qualify for the tournament proper, and then for sort of circumstances, allowed back in. Well, again, you know, no pressure. We weren't even here. Fair enough, I get that. But then they still had to do the business. And they did. They did just that. And it was a really strong team and all the stars aligned and they're champions. But they've got that. They won. Thank you very much indeed. What have we got since? And by contrast, in that post-66 era, Jason, one of the things culturally that I'm sick of is unlucky England. Oh, we lost on penalties. Oh, you know, if we'd have had Michael Owen fully fit. Oh, Rooney's metatarsal, etc., etc. They are so wide and varied. I mean, just fill your boots, Google England's World Cup woes, and there's just a litany of frankly excuses, right? And, you know, again, it's easy for me in my lovely little studio. You know, I'm many things in this life. I'm not a professional athlete and I'm certainly no football star. It's dead easy for me to point fingers. Don't like doing that. I like to be positive. But again, coming back to Southgate in that World Cup, that last one, let's not forget, because memories are short, England took the lead. They were playing beautifully. And for some reason, and this is cultural, this is deep, I don't know if it's psychological, I don't know what it is, but there was a reason for it. There's a reason for everything. They went insular. They went into their shell. And at this elite level, you can't invite teams of the caliber of Croatia to come at you for the best part of 80 minutes. Again, sporting cliche as it is, there's so much wisdom in this when it says that attack is the best form of defence. For me, that semi-final, I'm not saying they'd have won the final. I mean, that's too speculative. I'm utterly adamant that that semi-final was there for the victory. And we actually let it slip, like we've done in so many times in the past. Now, again, I don't know if that's Southgate. I hope he learned from it. I don't know if this comes down to the Behemoth and the psychology of the 66 ghost, which I don't buy as an excuse, or whatever it might be. My point, though, Jason, very simple. Even in the most recent example, that tournament was there for the taking and we fell short. Why?
Well, just before I start on that, I would say that I'm positive that maybe not Southgate. I'm not sure if I like him, but Southgate has ushered in a new era of change that we can try something different. So I thought I'd clear that up. But yes, this unlucky England narrative to me just reeks of losing mentality. You know, I don't want to come across as harsh. I don't want to sound, you know, a bit, you know, angry or offensive. But I agree with you that they invite pressure. They display a negative attitude. There's over-reliance on certain players. And if certain players get injured, then, oh God, the tournament's over before it's even begun. I mean, that is such a terrible mind frame to have. And you kind of see it as well with the press conferences leading up to tournaments. I remember in Euro 2004, or maybe it's the World Cup 2006, Wayne Rooney broke his foot. Well, after that, England had no chance. And even in the press conferences, the manager was fixated on Rooney coming back. When would he be back? Oh, goodness me.
Jason, he was on record saying that he was not fit enough for that tournament. Okay, and I, you know, don't get me wrong, I'm on record. I'm such a massive Wayne Rooney fan. He's England's all-time top scorer, right? But it's quite simple. If you are not fit enough at the elite level, then you're taking up a space and you're no longer an asset. Your reliability. And I just don't believe that somebody, given the sports technology and the kind of physiology awareness that we have at this era, I think that was 2008, I want to say. And, you know, they must have known. They must have known. And yet, almost on a wing and a prayer, because it's Wayne Rooney, Wayne will find that bulldog spirit and it'll fire a way through.
Yeah.
It's just naive. It's naivety of the highest degree. I'm flummoxed by it. But you've identified, I think, in a neat soundbite, it's this sense of almost star mentality when, in fact, it's got to be the team over and beyond and any individual. And then the individuals within that team flourish. I just cannot get over that mentality that's just categorized this post-66 era of just over-egging an individual, whoever that might be, and just some boneheaded decisions on selections. Quite simply, if you are not fit, you should not be there. End of discussion for me.
Yeah, I mean, what I would say to that as well, Tony, the only example of England actually going, our star injured player is out of the tournament, they then go on and win it. 66, Jimmy Greaves gets injured. And like you said, with the wingless wonders kind of approach, Alf Ramsey kind of said, look, guys, we've got our approach. Jeff Hurst is more than capable to come in. We're going to stick to our system. And I think this is a big, big problem. I think you totally agree with me here, Tony, that instead, and this goes back to my point about either philosophy or pragmatism, you play to the quality of your team. And that is where the belief comes from as well. That's how you build a culture. You have a leader that goes, it's all right, guys. It's so sad that Hujama Flip, whatever their name is in the future, let's say Rooney 2.0 is injured, but it's okay because we've got our backup, but we've got our play style. And I think, again, it's that loser mentality that we have in the England side. Instead of saying that, they go, guys, it's all over because Rooney's out. And that is so, so negative. It's so bad. And I think just the final point from me, what I see in the best players, the best, most world-class, and it's in any sport as well, is that problems are never them. It's something outside of them. You know, you look at Roger Federer. He would never say, I wasn't good enough today. He'd go, I was unlucky because so-and-so just played very well today, but I'll be back to my best. You know, they'll always bring it back. They always have that belief and they can see how they will win. Before they've even kicked off, they've won that match 1,000 times in their head. When you go in with this loser mentality, you've lost 1,000 times.
It's nothing wrong in defeat. And again, let's not forget, there are so many great countries around the world and we don't have a divine right to victory. I totally get that. What's frustrating for me, again, I'm going to put it into its frame. In the 50 plus, nearly 60 years since, we've had a Rugby World Cup win. We've had a T20 win. We've had a ODI glorious home victory. You know, like I say, the GB team year on year trending up. We've had Andy Murray win Wimbledon, right? A massive, massive sporting psychological pressure cooker proven to be something that we can conquer. My point is very simple. In context, considering all the advantages football has over and beyond all these other sports, rugby, tennis, cricket, would look at the infrastructure, the fan base, the infinite potential that football boasts just by its, for want of a better word, its DNA, its status in our sporting infrastructure, our mental psyche and our enjoyment of it, right? And for football to pale into insignificance compared to all these other sports, for me, it's shambolic. It's absolutely shambolic. I mean, you know, Jason, I try. I'm always a positive guy. But in context, I cannot find a slither of justification for this paucity of reward versus massive amounts of, you know, resource poured at it. If it was a business, it would, you know, it'd be burned under, it'd be done, it'd be over. Again, am I being too critical there? Am I buying in maybe despite myself to some type of degree of, you know, we, because of our resource, had ought to be victorious?
No, I don't think at all that you've kind of really, we both have unlocked quite a few reasons why England have had problems. And I think the resource thing actually adds to the narrative of the fact that they have underperformed. You know, with all these abilities, it just seems that there's a few things standing in the way. And that's what's so frustrating, because it's not an unrealistic goal. I think that's part of the problem with England, is the fact that it's not unbelievable to think that they can achieve these things. It's so, so close, and it's glaringly obvious to some the reasons why. And so I think that is why it's so hurtful, because it's not unrealistic to think that England could and should have won a few more tournaments.
So yeah, Jason, I think you've really made some wonderful, wonderful points there. And, you know, again, it's almost like the common denominator here is football. Like I say, we can talk, and we will get into it. The nature of the media's kind of perverse style of hype to then slam down. You explained wonderfully almost the way that the lack of expectation, lack of hype into the last World Cup yielded a modicum of success, relative success, shall we say, right? You know, but all these other sports have that same kind of media body and that same kind of pressures. Like I say, 77 years it was since Fred Perry won Wimbledon. Every single Wimbledon, there's going to be, oh, who's going to be the British winner? And God love him, Murray got that monkey, smashed it with an ace off his back and our national psyche. My point, therefore, is I accept these, but they apply across the board, and across the board, all of the sports, in, you know, not necessarily always consistently, not everything is always hunky and indeed dory, of course it's not, but each and every single sport that you care to mention has had something to hang their hat on in that nearly 60 years post 66. Whereas in football, bar a few inglorious failures, nothing. So the common denominator is football, not the X factors, media, pressure, whatever it might be, money. Again, they're constants. So what are we missing? Why? Again, it comes down to a philosophical question. Why haven't we yet cracked this nut?
Well, I think as well that the whole point of this media disturbance to the England team is again another kind of story that I definitely think is overplayed, because you look at countries like Brazil and Argentina where football is the national sport and in many ways it's almost on par with religion, you know, and Brazil obviously did fail at their own World Cup, but then Argentina have won it on South American soil so many times, you know, they've lived up to the day. And I look at countries as well, like Italy. And for those of you who've not watched it, the Diego Maradona documentary is truly fascinating. Mm-hmm. But for me as well, it was truly fascinating to see how golden boy Maradona was suddenly turned against by the media because he scored against Italy, send him out the World Cup and their chances gone, Argentina lift it. And this media kind of frenzy exists around the globe. Italy, in many countries around Europe, maybe not so much Germany, but definitely in South America as well. The problems are there with pressure. And, you know, as a footballer, as any sort of person in the media, they should be given probably more guidance. But what I would say is it's almost equal across the board in many of the big footballing nations around the globe. So, again, this story is not something that I believe at all, really. I do believe...
What I struggle with when it comes to pressure and the England football team, what I really struggle with, it's not like these guys haven't encountered pressure. You know, many of these have played at Champions League level. You know, many of them have won penalty shootouts at Champions League level. You know, they've gone down to final day of the season and deciders, where they, you know, winner takes all kind of context, played in FA Cups. You know, they've grown up. To be a professional footballer, you have to have lived with pressure your whole life to challenge yourself, to better yourself, et cetera, et cetera. So what I find peculiar is, what is it then about the Three Lions jersey that seems to turn these players who are superstars at a club level, who will almost like any sporting great when it comes to the big day? You think of Steven Gerrard's FA Cup final just off the top of my head, right? And even, again, in an England context, credit to David Beckham, for instance, that epic free kick he scored against Greece to save England's blushes once upon a time, proving that we are well capable of seizing the great moments. But, like I say, when people talk about pressure, the media pressure and this and that, I could understand it if it was unique and it's come out of nowhere. But my point is, these guys have excelled in pressure cooker domains. So again, what is it about that Three Lions jersey which seems to hype up the pressure? Or once again, is this just yet another kind of convenient excuse that we're kind of clinging on to?
100%, it's a convenient excuse. And, you know, like the great song goes, when the going gets tough, the tough get going. But I think there's a really good comparison actually to be made. It's not the jersey. And you look at Manchester United at the moment, I think this is a really good comparison to make, because when big players sign for them, when Harry Maguire joined there, the most expensive defender in footballing history, they talked about pressure and problems and this and that. But I think the problem with Manchester United, and again with England, is maybe this character of a lack of direction because of no director of football. You know, Manchester United have lost their way since Alex Ferguson. And, you know, other clubs, the Barcelonas, the Ajaxes, the Juventuses, they all have kind of clear identities and styles. You know, you can go to Barcelona, you say, it's this X style. Ajax is X style. Arsenal were X style, but then Wenger left and Emery kind of moved away from it. Manchester United were, yes, Ferguson was shape-shifting, but in a way, Ferguson was the style and he was the backmarker. Now, the fact that they don't have this direction, whether it be a leader as an individual, you know, Mourinho as well, pragmatic in his approach like Ferguson, but having a person or an idea to aspire to relieves the pressure, because in those tough moments, Barcelona kind of go, right, let's go back to plan A. We play our style, we play it better. You know, one of Pep Guardiola's, one of my favourite quotes from his is, when it gets hard, you don't go to plan B, you do plan A better. And for me, that is what England kind of lack. And in those pressure situations, if you had a plan A, I don't think there even is a plan A. That's part of the problem. When it gets tough, you can go, right, boys, we need to go back to that. In the dressing room, the manager or the captain would go, this is the way that we need to go back to. And then it's easier. Obviously, it doesn't solve all the problems. You know, every club around the world that has a philosophy or a really good, you know, pragmatic leader who they believe in doesn't win 100% of the time. But when you look at it, logically, most of those teams do well. So for me, having a clear, again, it kind of goes back to either an identity, building a culture. But this pressure thing, I don't believe it at all. As a footballer, you're trained to take penalties. And again, that's something that they can work on. But this weird thing of pressure on a day, I don't believe it at all. You know, as a professional, you're either coached to excellence and you'll be coached out of feeling that pressure, or the manager is failing you.
So let's circle back then to Gareth Southgate. There are shoots of optimism. We appreciate that. But as I say, in that pressure cooker moment, World Cup semi-final, 1-0 up, games there. And then to revert into this insular way of being. And again, nobody could tell me that that's a plan A or a plan B. It's so insular, so negative, when they literally, in the first 10 minutes, were looking so strong. You know, again, getting that first goal. Where does the tone set? Because what we need to do now, I think, is set the tone for this future and to grab the now, but appreciate that that now is a stretched one. So my question is very simple. For you, Jason, is Southgate capable of bridging the gap between a long-term vision and the tactical nous to instill the players with the faith in a style of football? Or, as you've mentioned already, is it disconcerting that for you there isn't yet even a pattern or a style that is characteristically Southgate's England?
Yeah, I think the latter for me. And, you know, I said a little bit earlier, I was happy that Southgate almost, you know, he's the person to start the revolution. He starts the fire, but he's not the one to see it kind of take over the place. And for me, I like Southgate. I really respect what he's done. But at the moment, he's not given me enough, because there is no clear identity. We discussed it before. There were 26 different players playing just in the midfield positions for England in the qualifiers since that World Cup jaunt, you know, getting to the semi-final. And then since then, 26 different midfielders. As I would say with any of the great clubs, you look at the likes of Manchester City, Barcelona years ago, Real Madrid and the pomp with Jose Mourinho, you could basically name 10 or 11 of that starting 11 every week in, week out. Chelsea in their heyday, when they won the league with, you know, the record least goals conceded, the Invincibles, the United treble, you just name any of them. And you can say the names of the players because there is a set pattern. And even now with the current best teams in the international scene, Spain, France, Germany have really clear kind of players or the types of players that they want to play. And so for me, the fact that Southgate hasn't even figured out his best team, and he's actually ignored a lot of really good players as well, just for me doesn't speak. For me, he has the kind of old problem that has really haunted England for so long, is that he has his favourites and he's going to stick with quite a few of them. You know, Pickford should not be between the sticks now. You either go with Pope or the young blood Henderson. And if it doesn't work out with Henderson or Pope, then that's all right, but at least you tried. Pickford has been tried and failed. The back line is a little bit more difficult, but you need to build it around players like Wan-Bissaka or TAA, Chilwell, Maguire, you know, the world-class or near-world-class players. And then midfield, why isn't Grealish starting? You know, one week it's Mount, one week it's Grealish, then it's Barkley, who somehow is making it into the team but doesn't play regular for Chelsea. And there's no rhyme or reason. So, yeah, for me, Tony, at the moment, I will give him the benefit of doubt until Euro 2021. But if there's no set style and pattern and I can go, oh yeah, that's how England play, then that's a failure to me.
tweet at Verulam Sport to know you got your opinions on this. Is Southgate the man to lead us to international footballing glory? It's been so long, 66 and all that. Goodness me, why on earth haven't we won anything in football since then, at least at the international arena? Love your views on this. We're doing our best to dissect it. Tweet at Verulam Sport. Keep involved. Jason, you know what? Again, we talk systems there. We're talking cultures. Of course we are. But I'm going to make this statement. I think this may be kind of as winding things up, right? Because again, we played the Chris Wokes piece earlier in this piece, and a man who, of course, is a bona fide World Cup winner. Now, one thing that was clear to me, and this again comes about to culture, when Andrew Strauss, who was absolutely critical in the reframing, the pivoting of focus in the England's cricketing psyche, where previously Test match had always been king, and you know we've won back the Ashes and we've had great Test match successes, et cetera, in the recent years, but we had abject failure in an ODI World Cup previous to this glorious one that's just gone. Where I think England crashed out in the group phases. Now Strauss, when he came in to the kind of almost the head, the director of English cricket, he was bold in his statement. And he said, we need to make a focus on the shorter forms of the game. We need to be like Australia, who are capable of transitioning into different forms of cricket. And we will be champions. He was bold. He didn't shy away from the failure. He wasn't talking incremental gains, but he was very clear that there was an identifiable issue. And then that took focus and it took a lot of hard work. It took a lot of soul searching. It took a lot of players who, quite frankly, weren't good enough going by the wayside as they rebuilt up to now champion, reigning World Cup champions in ODI and ranked number one in T20. Now, my point's this. Where is our equivalent leader in football? When are we going to have the gumption to say we need to commit to victory and anything less is not acceptable? Where are those characters? We're not going to say put Southgate's head on the block. But is there anybody in the England footballing culture now who is capable of being that much of a visionary and forcing us to do the kind of soul searching necessary to be a true champion?
It's a hard one to say, because if it doesn't come from within, kind of like the Andrew Strauss story that you've given us, then a lot of people, especially the England players and the manager himself, will think that it's outside meddling. And that would actually cause a lot of disruption and problems. Because, you know, if you look at Ferguson at Manchester United, the first few seasons, if there'd been an outside interference and he wasn't just allowed to get on with the job, he could have been gone sooner, or it could have disrupted the flow of one of the great growths. I think, first and foremost, that they kind of need to dedicate that one or two tournaments have to be written that this manager needs to control, unless it's absolutely, you know, abysmal, because they need to allow a philosophy or a chance to grow. But this idea of a leader, this, they can't be selected by a committee or something. It has to either be the manager or a captain themselves just brings it upon themselves, because I think it's really good if it's a player or the manager to kind of come up and say, look, we've got these problems. They need to be the ones to spearhead it, because at the end of the day, if it's an executive or an outside person, they don't know what's going on with the dressing room, the individuals. You know, the story that I hear quite often is, you know, fans go, why isn't X playing this week? And you look at somebody like Danny Rose, who has unfortunately suffered with depression. And for many weeks, you kind of heard TalkSport call-in lines lit up with, why isn't Danny Rose starting? Does he not love the club? Or has the manager turned against him? But the backroom story actually was that Danny Rose was suffering with a problem. Now, if there was a group of players here, now obviously I've said that England's not chosen a midfield. But I think it's a bit of a different story if you're choosing 26 different midfielders. Say if it was a group of five or six, then that's more leeway. Mm-hmm. At least you've got a stable unit. But 26 is taking the joke a little bit. I think that you need to have somebody from within who knows exactly what is going on. Otherwise, it won't work because you just don't know the ins and outs, the different relationships, and the reasons why. Truly, the reasons why.
But I tell you what, I get that. But my point is, somebody needs to take that because what that does, whether it's a Kane, a Southgate, or somebody else within the infrastructure, you're right, it has to be organic, it has to be internal. But that means then all of a sudden they are putting their pressure internally, but they're doing that as a marker. So nobody else, the media can say this or that. It doesn't matter. This is our standard. We are committing. We're recognizing the failures of the last 50 plus years. We can't control so much of that. This is our time now. We know what we did at the last World Cup. I look around and I see, you know, players who played at Champions League, players who have consistently been up at the top of the Premier League. We know what we can do as a group, and we're committing to this as a group. Now, whoever does that as a leader, if it's Southgate, I would say ideal, a Kane maybe, whatever. But again, you take away the external element of pressure because you're taking ownership of it. And you and I have both agreed that the element of pressure is not really a fair, justifiable excuse, right? But I say alleviate it by somebody internally taking on the Strauss model, which, again, within 4 years yielded Rugby World Cup, cricket ODI glory, okay? And I think that's generalship, that vision, and to say, almost, this is our standard and anything less isn't acceptable. So then the media can hype it up all day and all night long. It's not hype. We're saying this is the standard we're committing to. Fine. You want to build it up? We built it up. You can't say anything further. If they then want to castigate us because we don't live up to those standards, we're going to castigate ourselves even more. We set these standards. Now, that is how greatness is achieved. And again, I know it's not the same. I get it's not a completely like-for-like model, but it took less than 6 years for that effect to come to effect in England cricket's ODI focus. From Strauss's initial statement and focus to World Cup glory. Similarly, another visionary, Clive Woodward, who, Jason, I thought you made great points about the need to keep faith and kind of build around, because goodness me, goodness knows that the early phases of Woodward's reign was not exactly a shower of glory. But another visionary from 97, again, embracing lots of things from different cultures around the world, trying things, failing also very often, but picking himself up, acknowledging the failures and adjusting, adapting and gaining the lessons. World Cup glory 6 years later. My point is, from visionary, statement-led, focused, cultured infrastructure to World Cup glory can be much quicker than you might think.
What I would say is kind of like the Wenger versus Ferguson approach. You know, Wenger was kind of coaxing players, and I think that's the Southgate. You know, do it with niceness and belief and this, but the problem with that is if it doesn't pay off, players start to doubt, question, and they lose a little bit of that oomph, because Wenger, to me, maybe internally, but I can't imagine it, is not that kind of bullish character that would then go, look, I believed in you, but you're taking the mick now. Something like that. Whereas a Ferguson not only had himself, but he had the likes of Keane or Vidic,
yep.
These proper captains. And I think you're very right there. I think there are different types of management, because Pep Guardiola himself, I think he portrays a quality and a standard from his previous achievements, from his achievements as a player, but also he stokes belief psychologically. And I think it's very different to this holding yourself up, with a bullish character. He does it in a different way of kind of, look, we've achieved this before, I have achieved this before, you can achieve it with me. Whereas mm-hmm. a Ferguson will just get at you, a Keane will get at you and just tell it right to you, and maybe a little bit more than just tell it to you. And they are a leader more by actual words and action, whereas Kane is more a leader of example. And I think the problem with the mm-hmm. current England side is there is no character like that. And Southgate, because he isn't like Wenger, he's had no preceding previous success, the mm-hmm. players, when it gets hard, will not have that kind of level to measure themselves against. I mean, what can Southgate say? You know, oh, well, we got to the European Cup final with Middlesbrough. I mean, that's hardly very thought-invoking. Whereas somebody like Ferguson or Keane or even Mourinho now, because obviously he didn't win anything, but he can be aggressive, he can really get at you. And I think maybe the problem is as well that there's a leadership problem with England. And again, that's a natural thing that either has to come from the manager or a player who just has a really big character. And big characters are naturally developed. You can't thrust it upon somebody. And I think Kane is a wonderful player, really good. But the leadership has been thrust upon him basically because mm-hmm. he's the best player in the team. And I don't always think that the best player in the team makes the best leader.
No, it's a great, very great point. Well, look, again, I think it's important that we end on a positive. As I say, if you look in the recent sporting glories in England, again, it comes from sometimes very, very dark places and rebuilding. I don't think England football need to rebuild. Okay, I think, again, we have all the advantages that are the envy of the globe. So what we need to do is master what we have. And I would suggest, like I mentioned, somebody to step up and commit to the goal and get people excited about that goal and setting that as a standard, a baseline standard. And if you don't buy into that, if that scares you, you don't belong at this level. And that's necessary for me, but I'm sure it's possible. And I'm sure that the shoots of success are there. We just must seize the day. But for today, I want to say a massive, massive thank you, as always, to the machine, Jason McKenna. Some wonderful insights, as is his standard. I want to say a massive, massive thank you for you for listening, and always encourage you to get involved with us, your show, each and every single bit as much as it is ours. So to continue to tweet us at Verulam Sport, your take on why on earth England haven't claimed any international sporting success in football post 66. I dearly would love to hear from you. Make sure you tune into 92.6 FM next week for Sportcast 6-7. And always on the award-winning Radio Verulam website, check out our podcast. We're building ever closer to a magic century. But for now, thanks for listening.